Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. Peter Buxton believed in his work. He believed even more in his adopted country and what it stood for. When they were just 27 years old, his parents had fled Czechoslovakia to escape the Nazi regime when he was an infant. After graduating from the University of Oregon, he'd studied in the army as a psychiatric social worker, an assignment that set him up nicely for his first professional job as a venereal disease investigator for the United States Public Health Services. Based at San Francisco's Hall Clinic in 1965, Buxton happened to hear coworkers talking about an agency research study that had been going on for 40 years in a poverty-stricken rural part of Alabama. They were studying the effects of untreated syphilis among black men. The operative word here is untreated, like they weren't being given treatment, though treatment existed. Buxton said, quote, "It didn't sound like what a PHS institution should be doing," end quote. He didn't think most doctors would like it either. What about the Hippocratic Oath? What about first do no harm? Buxton needed more info. What he was hearing couldn't be the whole story, or even the truth. So he asked the Centers for Disease Control for more information on the study. He found it included more than 623 poorly educated black men, 400 or so who had syphilis, with the rest being a control group that did not. And the vast majority of the inflicted had never been treated for the disease. Like, ever. To Buxton's dismay, he also discovered that physicians in the service who had treated any of these men, say accidentally while attending to separate infections, were reprimanded for quote-unquote ruining one of our volunteers. What the physicians had done was give the man a course of penicillin, a veritable wonder drug that had been available since the 1940s. But not to the 400 syphilis-stricken men in Alabama. Buxton immediately saw the similarities between this study, as he understood it, and what the Nazis had done during the war when they had wantonly experimented on human subjects without their consent and without concern for their welfare. Buxton thought a lot of someone somewhere had missed the memo that this country did not behave this way. In November 1966, he wrote a report to Dr. William Brown, head of venereal disease for the Public Health Service, condemning the immorality of its actions in this case and questioning if the purpose of the study was simply to see how badly these men would die. He mentioned the Nazis. His supervisor agreed to send the report along, but wanted no part in the fallout he imagined was about to come Buxton's way. Another supervisor called his report trash. Though he received no reply, Buxton was nevertheless soon invited to Atlanta to a syphilis conference, where he was escorted into a small conference room for the express purpose of being berated by Dr. Brown, who insisted the men in the study were volunteers, and that the study was justifiable in 1932, given the tenor of the times then, and it was justifiable now, given the study's value to science. Buxton was referred to as a lunatic. He was not. A year later, he enrolled in the University of California at San Francisco's Hastings Law School. He was busy, but still took every chance he got to tell anyone who might listen about the study. A few people listened, but they didn't care. So Buxton wrote the USPHS again in 1969, charging them with abuse of these men who were, quote, quite ignorant of the effects of untreated syphilis, end quote. The right thing to do was simple, he wrote. Give the men treatment now and compensate them for their suffering. The PHS, knowing that the country was in the midst of a civil rights awakening that was sometimes violent, feared public disclosure would fan that flame, so they got themselves a blue ribbon panel to study the matter. That panel decided that, despite the fact that dozens of the untreated men had died sooner than the unaffected control group, treating the surviving men now offered the possibility of tragic side effects. They also figured that those who were already dead were owed a debt to make the study worthy of their sacrifice. That is, the study would continue, though in their words, it would be upgraded scientifically. As author James H. Jones noted in his comprehensive history of the Tuskegee syphilis study, quote, no one with training in medical ethics was invited to the Blue Ribbon Panel meeting, none of the participants were black, and at no point during the discussion that followed did anyone mention the PHS's own guidelines on human experimentation, end quote. Buxton asked everyone he knew, including his law professors, what to do in light of this development. Aside from a suggestion to inform the American Civil Liberties Union, no one had much to offer. It would be tough, even he knew, to challenge medical authority on this. And Buxton had to finish law school first. In July 1972, graduated now, he made his move by mentioning his continuing horror about what was happening in Alabama to a friend who was also an Associated Press reporter who knew a good story when she heard one. She handed the story and all of Buxton's notes, letters, and documents to Jean Heller, an investigative reporter for the AP based in Washington, D.C. It was an outrage that had been waiting in plain sight. A portion of the medical community had known about it for years. Journals had been publishing reports on its findings for more than 30 years. The Public Health Service had not tried to keep it a secret, because they were not troubled by it, on any grounds. 50 years later, Heller remembered Buxton's tip in an Associated Press report.
He had picked up reports of some study that was going on in Alabama that was being done on poor black farmers there. The person he reported to said, this really isn't part of your job. Don't worry about it. It's none of your business. I could not believe that an agency of the federal government, as much as a mistake as it was initially, could let this continue for 40 years. It just made me furious. None of the morality was ever questioned.
The story broke in the Washington Star on July 25th, 1972. The headline, Syphilis Victims in U.S. Study Went Untreated for 40 Years. The next day, the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare launched a full investigation into the study. They were reported to be shocked and horrified to hear of its existence. If you don't know much about syphilis, consider yourself lucky. It's an ugly, stigmatized disease that's been treated as straight-up disgraceful anytime there's been an outbreak. A paper published by the Journal of Medicine and Life said that countries routinely have blamed neighboring, often enemy, countries. From the paper's introduction, quote, So the inhabitants of today's Italy, Germany, and United Kingdom named syphilis the French disease. The French named it the Neapolitan disease. The Russians assigned the name of Polish disease. The Polish called it the German disease. The Danish, the Portuguese, and the inhabitants of Northern Africa named it the Spanish Castilian disease. And the Turks coined the term Christian disease. Moreover, in northern India, the Muslims blamed the Hindu for the outbreak of the affliction. However, the Hindu blamed the Muslims, and in the end, everyone blamed the Europeans. End quote. The disease's origin story isn't totally clear. Some people believe the first version of syphilis appeared well into the BCs, but we'll focus on the AD incarnations. It was recognized in 15th century Europe as a new disease, after which it was believed to infect many famous people, including political figures like King Charles VIII, Queen Mary I, Catherine the Great, Paul I, and Vladimir Lenin. Writer Leo Tolstoy is suspected to have had it, as was philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. Al Capone died from it, as did blues singer Alger Texas Alexander. The symptoms of the disease aren't pretty.
So you develop what we call a chancre or an ulcer at the site of infection. Now this can occur anywhere in the body.
That's Dr. Dominic Rowley from the Let's Get Checked YouTube channel. Don't worry, I won't get too graphic with all this, but as Dr. Rowley explains, syphilis starts quietly with an ulcer, then spreads all around your body. You might get headaches or dizziness or suffer hearing problems. Your lymph glands might swell up in your throat or under your arms. Then it enters its most serious phase when it can affect your brain.
It can cause dementia or an Alzheimer's type disease. It can also affect your heart, the arteries of your heart. It can cause aneurysms and also affects your bones. So it can be a very, very serious infection when it's at its third stage.
The condition has always fascinated doctors. Between 1891 and 1910, researchers in Oslo, Norway, examined several hundred white men who had untreated syphilis. In 1929, they published a report that said that cardiovascular issues, most leading to death, were far more common than those associated with neurologic or brain functioning. That generally jibed with what doctors in the U.S. had been seeing in their black patients as well, but not everyone was convinced. Dr. Taliaferro Clark was a man of his age. That is to say, he didn't push back on the generally accepted belief of his time that white men knew better than anyone and that white doctors knew better than other white men. That meant that Dr. Clark was pretty sure he was always right and was rarely challenged. He had spent some time in the poorest regions of Alabama as part of his work as director of the Venereal Disease Division of the Public Health Service and was in the midst of analyzing some data when, as he later recalled, quote, "The thought came to me that the Alabama community offered an unparalleled opportunity for the study of the effects of untreated syphilis," end quote. What he did not take note of was something Virginia Wirtz, the daughter of a study participant, emphatically stated in 2022.
"The men were loved. All of the men in the study was someone's son."
Dr. Clark maybe never saw that. He was too enthralled with his idea. Here was a region in and around Macon County, most specifically the town of Tuskegee, in the eastern and central part of the state, and home to what was then the foremost center of African American education, the Tuskegee Institute. It also had the John A. Andrew Memorial Hospital at the Institute, where all the necessary examinations could be conducted and all the physicians and staff were black. The Institute, Clark hoped, could give its stamp of approval to a study. The men who would be studied could be drawn from the uneducated sharecroppers who toiled in the cotton fields of the region, A perfect circumstance, as they rarely had the benefit of any kind of health care because they did not trust it and could not afford it anyway. They could barely feed and clothe their families. Now, it might not seem like it, but Clark wasn't necessarily simply an asshole. He didn't see a group of poor black men and think, hey, let's see how they deal with untreated venereal disease for funsies. The fact is, 35% of all black males in the region had the disease, and Clark was a rigorous clinician. He wanted to know more about the disease. Specifically, he wanted to know the disease's effects on the black population. Clark believed, despite reports to the contrary, that in the general population of people who had contracted syphilis, white people showed cardiovascular involvement, while black people were much more in danger of having neurological involvement. He believed that the disease behaved in vastly different ways in the different races. He and the Public Health Service of the United States could study that, he figured. It wouldn't take long. He would study the men for 6 months to a year and then shift things. Instead of just observing a group of untreated syphilitic patients, he would change things up and then, you know, treat them. Convincing the Alabama State Board of Health and the County of Macon was not hard. It would cost them little and would provide health care of some kind to the poor sharecroppers. They were all in, except for one thing. Health board officials and Macon County's private doctors insisted on a partial program of treatment from the start. As an aside here, in the 1900s, Paul Ehrlich, a German chemist, found that compounds of dangerous metals such as arsenic-based drugs, which were injected, and mercury, used as a rub, were effective in treating the disease. The arsenic compounds had a big, long chemical name but was marketed as Salverson. The work earned Ehrlich a Nobel Prize in 1908. It is the first use of what we now know as chemotherapy. Now, Salverson was mighty toxic stuff, especially in the hands of those not trained in its complicated and lengthy dosage requirements. It was also known to be difficult and painful to inject, sometimes causing rashes and even vein and liver damage. The upshot was that Clark's untreated patients would be treated in some way. A PR campaign was launched to convince the white farmers who employed the sharecroppers to let their employees participate. That proved relatively easy. All the study's backers had to do was convince the farmers that the program would translate to less downtime from illness and give the appearance that they cared about their workers. Convincing the institute doctors was a tad harder, but given that it was a teaching hospital and that the government's best doctors were convinced that syphilis in black patients was almost a completely different disease than the one experienced by whites, well, they were in. Dr. Raymond Vondelaer, white, 35, and idealistic, was put in charge of the study and, importantly, did a lot of the field work it entailed. He was joined by a young black nurse named Eunice Rivers. Nurse Rivers was born and raised in Macon County, educated at the Tuskegee Institute, the daughter of a man who had little education but required it of his oldest daughter. She was 9 years out of school, the depression was on, and she was thrilled to get work as special scientific assistant for the study. This meant that she not only did nursing work, but transported many of the participants to and from their appointments, offering what medicine she could, such as aspirin, access to which many of the men had never had. She would prove to be indispensable to the Tuskegee study. Able to talk to the men she was assigned to study in a way that they understood, and able to talk to the clinicians in their language too. An example, She told the doctors that if you want the men to keep coming back at first, offer them a hot lunch. If you were worried they'd drop out later, offer them life insurance and burial benefits. She would remain the only constant those men would know for almost the entire duration of the study. Soon enough, the government doctors, which is how the men usually referred to the study's physicians, began recruiting for volunteers. They visited the black churches and schools in the area, offering free blood tests to those interested. For people who had never had a lick of health care in their lives that did not come from their mothers, this was too good to be true. Hundreds of people showed up. Those who tested positive for syphilis per an antibody test were tested again, then, if positive again, invited back for a full physical exam. They were given to understand they had bad blood, a vague colloquial term that encompassed all kinds of conditions, anemia included, that the doctors soon adopted. They were never told they had syphilis. Ernest Hendon, one of the men selected to be in the study, was told,
"Here was a program they said would happen. The people you know on it, you know, if they join that, they could, get some results out of it, some medical care, something like that. I might have been 20 years old then. I never could understand what it was all about."
According to the administrators of the study, participants had to be 25 and have never been given any kind of treatment, though now they were given Salverson. There was a hitch to all of this, though. It was the Depression. There wasn't enough Salverson to go around, and there was little money to procure more. Still, the offer of free healthcare had resulted in hordes of people wanting help. By the time 1934 rolled around, 6 treatment clinics were open to treat as many as 500 men a week. These were open to more than just the study subjects, though those men got priority. Still, there simply wasn't enough medicine to go around. The maximum treatment each had been given was less than half that recommended by the PHS to cure syphilis. So it's not surprising that later, when 50 or so of those on the half-dose regimen were retested, only 3% showed any serological reversal. Soon enough, the money for meds ran out altogether, and the treatment stopped for what the doctors and Nurse Rivers believed was a temporary 6-month period. It would never resume. Dr. Vonderleer, meanwhile, was getting the men in the study into the hospital regularly for chest x-rays. He was not a radiologist, but he had the help of Dr. Jerome Peters, a black doctor who worked for the Veterans Administration and who was a pathologist as well as a radiologist. Both saw an abundance of pathologies in the cardiovascular system of the black men under their care, which meant only one thing. The disease progressed in black men exactly as the Oslo study said it did in white men. Those little spirochetes causing syphilis did not give a good goddamn what color you were. That could have been a eureka moment that halted the study and shifted the doctor's focus back where it should have been, on treating men suffering from syphilis. But that's not what happened.
Thank you.
No matter how closely Dr. Vanderleer looked for any signs of neurosyphilis in his black patients, he couldn't find any. He reasoned this away. Maybe those symptoms wouldn't show up until the tertiary stage of the disease. But still, it bothered him because the whole premise of the study was that it did show up earlier in black men than in white. Why wasn't he seeing any sign of it early on in any of the men? Dr. Clark consoled him, explaining that it was hard to recognize cognitive impairment in men who had such low intellect to begin with and lacked cultural awareness. Okay, so it turns out Dr. Clark was an asshole after all. Now, Dr. Clark had a thesis that syphilis quickly affected black men's brains, and instead of looking objectively at what his data told him, he instead shifted in the spring of 1933 to confirm his thesis. He did this by aiming to obtain spinal taps, which he hoped would provide the proof he so desperately wanted. If you've never had one, spinal taps are hard to do, and they can be excruciatingly painful. In Tuskegee, they involved a large needle extracting spinal fluid from the spinal column without any anesthesia. Severe headaches regularly occurred after. There was always also the chance of causing permanent paralysis. The men recruited for this were not told what the testing entailed. All they were told was that one final special treatment, for free, was available to them. The plan was to schedule and do as many of these spinal taps as could be done in rapid succession so that early patients couldn't spread word to later patients, thus causing them to opt out of the tests. Nurse Rivers began recruiting. Form letters were sent out explaining that volunteer patients might have to stay overnight in the hospital, but don't worry, they'd be taken care of. The letters concluded that this was their, quote, last chance for special free treatment, end quote. Charlie Pollard remembered his.
All right, well, pretty bad. That spinal tap, of course, I did along pretty good with it, but I stayed in the bed a week or two.
More than 300 of the 407 in the study at that time agreed to the spinal tap procedure. Afterwards, many felt duped, losing trust in the government doctors who had tricked them into undergoing a deeply unpleasant test that did absolutely nothing to treat their syphilis symptoms. The PHS doctors shrugged off the sense of betrayal. No real harm was done, they figured. And besides, the study was almost over. The official end date for the United States Public Health Service study of untreated syphilis in the male Negro was officially May of 1933. Even Nurse Rivers was let go. Then Dr. Clark retired as head of the venereal disease section of the service and was replaced by Dr. Vanderleer, who wasn't ready to let the study die. He had worked on it for years, and he believed in it. He imagined that following the study participants long-term could yield fascinating and useful insights. The study, it was decided, would continue. James H. Jones explained in his analysis of the study that this was only the first time a change in doctors would keep the program alive. Every time a doctor would move on from the position as head of the department, he was replaced by a doctor who had worked on and believed in the study. So it was self-perpetuating, now with study administrators going out of their way to make sure no one treated their quote-unquote volunteers following the men for the duration of their lives, their names appearing on lists throughout Macon County, and eventually beyond, as patients who were not to be given any real medical care. Let me repeat that. The study participants' names were distributed to outside doctors and medical facilities as people who were not to be given real medical care. This included the use of penicillin for any bacterial infection, after the drug became widely available in the 1940s, for fear its introduction into the systems of the participants might skew the study's results, which seems unnecessarily rigorous and, of course, immoral as hell. Dr. John Cutler worked as a medical officer for the PHS from 1942 to 1967. He was the one who would later refer to Peter Buxton as a lunatic. Here he is defending the study.
We have no compunction about sending our youth away to war when it's in the national interest. And in terms of syphilis, was the leading cause of infant maternal mortality, leading single cause of admission to mental hospitals, and many other things. So it was in the national interest to get the information so that you could provide the greatest protection for the entire community, black and white.
When World War II broke out, the study had to jump through new hoops to make sure that participants either were not taken into the armed forces or were exempt from treatment for syphilis while there. In 1943, Dr. John Heller became head of the Public Health Service's Department of Venereal Disease. It would have seemed a particularly fabulous time to call a halt to the study, as penicillin was now available for easy distribution to the men, and it worked really well to cure syphilis. That was not even discussed, Dr. Heller would say years later. Around the same time, when Alabama law mandated that everyone between 4 and 50 be tested for tuberculosis and venereal disease and treated if found to be infectious, the study was exempted. Then, immediately after the war, when the extent of the Nazi war crimes became known, including the immoral and unethical experimentation on human beings, every doctor in America expressed horror and revulsion at the breach in not only medical ethics, but of humanity itself. That didn't raise much concern in the venereal disease division, as they saw no parallel. And the study continued, with special effort made to find even those men who no longer lived in or near Tuskegee. Study participant Ernest Hendon remembered,
"After I went to Cleveland, they still kept in contact with me. Sometime one white man used to come up there and see me about once a year."
Throughout the study, the PHS doctors had to solidify the help they'd get from the region's doctors, the state health department, Macon County, and from the hospital on the Tuskegee campus. In every case, the service overcame the hurdles. It was probably because there was some logic, however skewed, working here. Dr. Vondelaer felt if he could prove that syphilis among black people was not trivial, that it harmed them as much as it did those who were white, even if that harm presented itself a bit differently, he could convince federal and state legislatures to fund widespread treatment for all. It was his means that could not bear scrutiny. He thus proceeded with vigor, deciding that Nurse Rivers would continue as the chief field officer, though she would not carry that title, checking on every participant's progress now with an emphasis on obtaining autopsies after death. Yes, you heard me right. The idea now was let's not treat them and let's make sure no one else treats them. And then let's open them up when they die so we can see how much damage has been done and to which organ. Now, syphilis is largely asymptomatic until the final stage when the patient is already actively dying, when even the poorest of men might seek private care. It was decided they needed to get local doctors to agree to notify the study if any participant came to them for care or if they had issued a death certificate for them. The meetings held with these outside entities were candid. Again, everyone understood that the study had not and did not want any of their participants treated for the disease. They understood and they acquiesced. The agreement was sealed that all autopsies of men in the study would be conducted at Andrew Hospital at the Institute. Getting the families to agree to a postmortem examination was Nurse River's job. She was very good at it. Truth is, she was always really good with the men and their families. She was the liaison between the doctors and the men. The time she spent with them individually was incalculable. At first, she expressed dismay at cutting up people's dead bodies. She said she found it, quote-unquote, crude. But she came around. Armed with assurance that the bodies would be returned to the families intact and that they would have enough burial insurance, it amounted to $500, to ensure a proper funeral and gravestone, she eventually would approach 145 families for permission to autopsy their loved ones. Only one family declined. The cost of the burial insurance, by the way, initially was covered by the Rosenwald Fund, a philanthropy founded by one of the owners of Sears, Roebuck & Company. You know how I love an aside, so here's a small one for you. Fever debate has waged over Nurse River's actions since the day the story of the study broke nationally. Some have found her to be what they call a race traitor, while others find her care for the men she served to be exemplary and self-sacrificing. Retired in 1968, Nurse Rivers fell mostly silent about what she knew, having previously said that the care the men got was more than they ever would have received if the study had not been part of their lives. She said she did not see it as a civil rights issue, unable to find the racism inherent in it. She maintained, always, that caring for those men was, quote, the joy of my life, end quote. In the 1950s, the Tuskegee study of syphilis sort of morphed into a study of aging. Doctors admitted that they weren't sure that some causes of death were natural or related to other diseases aside from syphilis. Many of the men had outlived the time in their lives when they were at highest risk, as most of the damage done to syphilitics occurred when they were young. The data on both the untreated and the control group came in almost daily on the remaining living subjects of the study, with PHS doctors making occasional trips back to Alabama to look over and examine the men, still with no discussion of the moral impropriety of it. There were some outside the study who did discuss such things. Erwin Schatz, a young Detroit doctor, wrote an article in the mid-1960s asking the service to, quote, reevaluate their moral judgments, end quote. That was followed by Dr. Bill Jenkins sending letters to major newspapers with information on the study in 1967. The wrongdoing just didn't register. Nurse Rivers kept making the rounds, encouraging the men to keep cooperating, and tending to their wives and children as she could, attending funerals of the men she had known now for decades. Then, Tuesday, July 25th, 1972, dawned, and papers landed on doorsteps in Washington, D.C. The next day, it was front page news in the New York Times. The nation gasped. In 1974, the NAACP hired Fred David Gray to represent the study's participants. Gray, a native Alabamian, had represented Rosa Parks when she refused to take a back seat on a Montgomery bus and won the class action lawsuit that allowed marchers to proceed from Selma to Montgomery under the protection of those who had previously beaten them for their attempt. He was also the man who forced Alabama to integrate its public institutions, despite Governor George Wallace's protest to the contrary. After prolonged negotiation, Fred Gray got a $10 million settlement for the living participants and the surviving heirs of the men in the Tuskegee study, who also were to receive free health care for the rest of their lives. Also that year, Congress passed the National Research Act, which created the National Commission for the Protection of Human Subjects of Biomedical and Behavioral Research, which detailed the manner in which humans can be used for research and further codified the informed consent law that had been established in 1957 and that now touches almost all medical procedures. For almost 20 years, study participant Herman Shaw led an effort for some kind of meaning to come out of all that pain and all that deceit. He wanted an apology.
In order for America to reach its full potential, we must truly be one America. Black, red, white together, trusting each other, caring for each other, and never allowing the kind of tragedy which has happened to us in Tuskegee study to ever happen again.
On May 16, 1997, a quarter century after the study was outed and then terminated, President Bill Clinton formally apologized to the men and their families.
So today America does remember the hundreds of men used in research without their knowledge and consent. We remember them and their family members. Men who were poor and African American, without resources and with few alternatives. They believed they had found hope when they were offered free medical care by the United States Public Health Service. They were betrayed. To the survivors, to the wives and family members, the children and the grandchildren, I say what you know. No power on earth can give you back the lives lost, the pain suffered, the years of internal torment and anguish. What was done cannot be undone, but we can end the silence. We can stop turning our heads away. We can look at you in the eye and finally say, on behalf of the American people, what the United States government did was shameful, and I am sorry.
Ironically, some of the study's participants were not enthusiastic about the new attention given to them. Virginia Wirtz, whose father was in the study, explained that some of the men felt it had revealed to the world their ignorance.
The men were angry at first, in disbelief. There was trauma, and there was shame.
Which is yet another of the study's crimes, if you ask me. There were no prosecutions for crimes against humanity. No one was even reprimanded. A final report did conclude that the study was, quote, ethically unjustified in 1932, end quote, that withholding penicillin amplified the injustice, that the results of the study were relatively meager when weighed against the violation of basic ethical principles pertaining to human dignity. Jay Katz, a Yale University professor on the panel, added that, quote, the life expectancy of at least 40 was markedly decreased for lack of treatment, end quote. Yes, the study had killed people. Reporter Heller, 50 years after she helped terminate the study, still has questions that the Public Health Service hasn't bothered to answer.
What we don't know is how many of their wives they infected, how many of their children caught it in the womb, how many of them died, how many people got terribly, terribly ill.
On November 30th, 2022, a day of recognition, remembrance, and reflection took place in Tuskegee to honor the 632 men who participated in and were victimized by the study. Peter Buxton was there. Oh, and one last thing. In February 2024, a new CDC report found that syphilis cases, including those that are congenital, are the highest they've been since the 1950s, up 80% over the past 5 years. To research this case, journalist Amy Wilson read Bad Blood, The Tuskegee Syphilis Experiment, A Tragedy of Race and Medicine by James H. Jones, and the final report of the Tuskegee Syphilis Study, Ad Hoc Advisory Panel, 1973. She also perused a lot of newspapers from 1972, watched Voices of the Tuskegee Study, a production of the Tuskegee Human Rights and Civil Rights Multicultural Center from 2002, Bad Blood by the Historical Recovery Channel, and 50 years later, Syphilis Study Still Haunts America by the Associated Press. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rassman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Ben Scoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at